Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
And so when he attacks you, when he intimidates you, when he tries to get you to move from your position or to give up, what are you to do? It tells you right there in verse 13, you're to stand. No, I am not going to be shaken. You see, it's this emphasis that is so plain in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11 and verse 13. Should we just read that again? Look at the emphasis on standing. Look at it there, verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand.
It's no secret that there is a spiritual battle always at work for the Christian. We're oftentimes hit with temptations, doubts, and fears by the enemy. But in today's message, Pastor David explains that the Apostle Paul tells us to take a stand. When the enemy tries to trick us, tempt us, or scare us, we need to put on the armor of God. And through his strength, peace, and truth, we can stand firm. Of course, we do not do this through our own strength, but through the love of God, we will not be shaken. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
You have to be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. But then after that, what do? Well, you have to have the whole armor of God. Look at verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now, the armor of God will be explained more fully in the next passage. But the emphasis here in verse 11 is on the whole armor of God. And that's the emphasis in the Greek construction here. God gives the believer a full set of equipment. He sends us out with all we need to fight the battle. Every once in a while you hear it either in modern day accounts or in history, you know, maybe from, you know, wars in the last century or wars in ancient history. You read these stories about soldiers being sent out into battle without the right equipment, right? They're sent out to battle in the snow, but they have no snow or cold weather equipment. They're set out to fight with their rifles, but there's no bullets for their rifles. You know, this idea, sending the soldier out to fight this battle, but he isn't equipped. He doesn't have what he needs to fight. And you read that and you go, man, that's terrible, isn't it? Wouldn't it be terrible? You're pushed out into the battle, but you don't have the things you need to fight it. Well, Paul's trying to tell you, God never does that with us. God will never push you out into the battle without making available to you all the armor you need. You can put on the whole or the complete armor of God. I think it's very interesting that this ancient Greek word for armor is used in only one other place in the New Testament. You know where it's used? It's used in Luke chapter 11, where Jesus spoke of the strong man who was fully armed but was stripped of his armor when a stronger one came. And the idea is that your enemy has armor, and God has given you armor to, so to speak, counter your enemy. So put on the whole armor, and I love this, the whole armor of God. I'm so happy he didn't say the whole armor of David. That would be rough, wouldn't it? If I had to supply my own armor? What does it mean that it's the whole armor of God? I think it means it in two senses. First of all, it's the whole armor of God in that one, it is from him, right? He gave it to you, right? He says, here's some armor. You put it on. It's from him. But I tell you, there's an even more precious sense in which this is the armor of God. It is the armor of God in that it is his armor. Did you know that the Lord himself wears armor? What, you don't believe me? Keep your finger here. Turn back to Isaiah chapter 59, verse 17. Matter of fact, I think that Paul had this passage in mind when he was composing this exhortation to the Ephesians and to us. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 17 speaks really eloquently about the Lord's armor. See it here, verse 17. For he put on a righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with zeal as a cloak. Don't you see how Paul had this in mind when he was composing this passage? And so you see how precious it is for him to put on the whole armor of God. It's as if God in heaven says, here, you take my armor. You can fight with my armor. And then why? Why do we put on this whole armor? It says right there in verse 11. So that we may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. We express the strength we have. Okay, think of this. Here's the strong soldier, right? He's strong in the Lord and the power of his might. He's fully equipped. He's got all the armor he needs on. What does he do with it? He stands against the wiles of the devil. In other words, the idea is that Satan has a strategy. He has a deception. He has a plan that he wants to implement. And because we're strong, because we have the whole armor of God, we stand against it and we prevent it. The idea in verse 11 is mainly defensive. Paul will deal with the offensive later, but it's mainly defensive, the idea there in verse 11. Now, going on to verse 12, he's introduced the idea of being strong in the Lord and the idea of the whole armor of God. Now he's going to describe the dynamic of spiritual warfare in verse 12, where he says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." Now, I think this is absolutely interesting here. Take another look at verse 12. Is verse 12 an invitation to enter into spiritual warfare? I don't regard it as such. I do not regard verse 12 as an invitation to enter spiritual warfare. It is instead a declaration of fact. You're in it. Listen, I don't have to tell you to enter into spiritual warfare. You're in it. Now, maybe you're, I should be careful of my spirit. I was going to say, maybe you're so dumb. But I would just say the same to myself. Maybe we're so misguided that we don't recognize we're in spiritual warfare and we're just getting beat silly all the time. But you know, I don't have to tell you to enter into it. You're in it. You're a child of God. You're following after his faith. You're in it. Hello, welcome to the warfare. Here you are. You're in it, whether you like it or not. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers. You're in it. You are in a spiritual battle. If you are ignorant of the fact, if you ignore the fact, you're probably not winning that battle. And then he says here, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. The fact that our real battle is not against flesh and blood is lost upon many Christians. They seem to put all their energy, all their effort into flesh and blood. Paul's idea here is much the same as what he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 and 4. Listen to this carefully. He said, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds." Now, doesn't that sound great? I mean, it sounds like the same idea. And so what do we fight against? Not against flesh and blood, but against, as he says here, principalities, powers, the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Paul uses a variety of terms to refer to our spiritual enemies. We should regard them because the idea here seems to be that they are on many different levels and of many different ranks. And I don't really understand it. Now, you understand how in the military, you know, you have the general, and then you have the colonel, and then you have the major, and then, you know, you have your different levels of rank, right? Apparently, in some way that we don't fully understand, these are spiritual ranks of wickedness. And I can't tell you if a power is greater than a principality or where it connects to the ruler of the darkness of this age or these different ranks. I don't think it's really important. I think what Paul wants us to understand is that they're organized against you. They have an organization. They have a chain of authority. And they have one goal. And that goal is to knock the Christian down from their place of standing. That's what the Christian warfare is about. To combat the wiles of the devil, right? That's what he said in verse 11. At the end of the day, it's completely irrelevant. I don't want anybody to think that your job in spiritual warfare is to say, now, are you a principality or a power? Maybe you're a ruler of the darkness of this age. Maybe you're a spiritual host of wickedness. I don't know. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. They're all part of a spiritual army that's organized and established into ranks under the evil headship of Satan, the devil, who comes against us with all of their wiles. Now, we've been introduced to this idea of principalities and powers and angelic beings before in the book of Ephesians. There's really no need to go into it in more depth other than just to say that these represent angelic beings who have been unfaithful to God and are now in some sort of organized rebellion against God, which, might I say, that God has allowed for his good purpose. Nobody should think for a moment that God is somehow struggling in this battle against principalities and powers. You know, and maybe someday God will get enough resources, enough strength, enough might to defeat this. This isn't like, you know, Star Wars. It's not the yin and the yang. It's not the good part of the force and the dark side of the force. It's not that. We may struggle against these principalities and powers, but God allows them because at the end of it all, they serve his greater purpose. Now, I know you may have a problem with that. You say, how could you do this, God? How could you allow Satan to do things, horrible things, and yet you're going to tell me that somehow it serves your greater purpose? I don't understand that, God. Well, I have to tell you, too, I don't completely understand it. And I may not be able to explain it in your specific situation, but I do know that perhaps the ultimate example of that principle is clear to all of us. Was there ever a more wicked act that took place on this earth that when a man was possessed by Satan and when he betrayed the Son of God, and then the Son of God was crucified by a cooperative effort from both Jew and Gentile and nailed on a cross, and when he died, people laughed. Is there anything worse than that in all of human history? That the totally sinless, pure Son of God was treated this way? And that you and I look at it and we say, that's the glory of our salvation. God, you use that. Now, in the same way, after the same fashion, I can't explain all the ways that God has allowed principalities and powers and all the rest of them to do their thing in this world. I know he could stop them in a moment. He could stop them with a thought from his mind. But yet, they serve his greater purpose, and we should be on the winning side of that battle in our own life. In any regard, now verse 13. It says, therefore, in light of all this opposition that you have, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Now, Paul introduced the idea of the whole armor of God back in Ephesians 6:11. And in the following passage, he's going to detail the specific items related to the armor of God. Here, don't miss verse 13, here in verse 13, he simply tells us what the main purpose of spiritual warfare and the armor of God is. Do you understand what it's there for? It's so that you can do something, so that you may be able to withstand in the evil day and having done all to stand. I'm going to say something, and it might be controversial, and who knows, maybe if I teach on this in another couple months, I might tell you something different. But I'm just going to tell you how I see it tonight, right now at this time. I see it that many Christians have a wrong idea about spiritual warfare. They picture the Christian army as assaulting the kingdom of hell, and sort of like we're out on patrol against demons and spiritual enemies, right? I mean, that's what an army does, right? There's bad guys out there. And so we get into our vehicles and we drive around with the machine guns and we look for bad guys and hunt them down. And much of this is based on a misunderstanding of Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, where Jesus said, "And I say to you that you're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." And some people take from that idea that well, you know, as the church were to be bombarding the gates of hell, and there we are. And listen, part of that, I don't mean to criticize it. Let's have an active understanding of these. Let's have sort of this aggressive mentality in the Christian life. That's great. Instead, though, I think what that passage is really speaking about is that the gates of Hades, well, in the ancient world, the city council, the judges, the city leadership gathered together at the gates of the city. It's the place where the city life was planned and organized and strategy. When Jesus spoke of the gates of Hades, he meant that no satanic strategy, no plot from hell would ever ultimately succeed against the church. Let me suggest to you a different perspective on spiritual warfare. Instead of picturing the army of the church seeking out and attacking some kind of demonic fortress somewhere, I think we're to have the idea that Jesus illustrated in his ministry. Jesus didn't patrol around looking for demons to conquer. That would almost be allowing demons to set the agenda for his ministry. Instead, what did Jesus do? Jesus knew what God the Father wanted him to do. And he set out and he goes, I'm going to do it. Now, as he set himself out to do what God wanted him to do, demonic powers would come and try to oppose him or resist him or shake him from that. And what would Jesus do? Jesus said, forget it. I'm going to conquer it. Every time satanic opposition raised itself, Jesus stood against it and he was not moved. So this is the image I want you to have in your mind in this. That God has given us a call. He's given us a mission, a course to fulfill, and Satan is going to do his best to stop it. And so when he attacks you, when he intimidates you, when he tries to get you to move from your position or to give up, what are you to do? It tells you right there in verse 13, you're to stand. No, I am not going to be shaken. You see, it's this emphasis that is so plain in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11, and verse 13, should we just read that again? Look at the emphasis on standing. Look at it there. Verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand. Now look at verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all, to stand. Should I pile on a little more? Look at verse 14. Stand therefore. And I think he even continues it on even more. Well, you get the point there. The whole idea here is that the emphasis of the goal, the effect, the purpose of the strength of God, the armor of God in our life is so that we would stand. We do the Lord's work and we stand against every hint of spiritual opposition. We're not going to give into it. We're not going to be intimidated by it. And we're not going to let it stop us. See, I would suggest to you that God gives the Christian a glorious standing to maintain by faith and in spiritual warfare. You get out your concordance. Nobody uses concordance anymore, right? Use the Bible search program on your computer, right? Fire up your computer, type in the search word stand or standing in the New Testament, and you're going to see some things that'll surprise you. You'll see that we stand in grace, that we stand in the gospel, that we stand in courage and strength, that we stand in faith, that we stand in Christian liberty, that we stand in Christian unity, that we stand in the Lord, that we stand perfect and complete in the will of God. Now, doesn't Satan want to move you off of that standing? This is the place that God has given you to stand, to live your life for him. I like the same idea. It's there repeated in 1 Peter chapter 5. Be sober. Be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Listen, all in all, there's a lot wrapped up in that little five-letter word, stand. You know, I tell you, it means an awful lot there. It means, you know what it means? It means you're going to be attacked. Right? Soldier, stand your ground. Soldier, don't be moved. It's all vain if you're never going to be attacked. Oh, so when he tells you stand, you should expect that things will come along to shake you from that standing that you have. It means that we must not be frightened. If you're going to stand and hold your ground and fight the battle, you can't be frightened, can you? What do frightened people do? Do they stand? They run. He didn't say run. He said stand. It must mean as well that we must not droop or slouch. We're not uncertain or half-hearted in the fight. We're not slouching. We're standing at attention. That's a call to a military man. You're ready to fight, right? Soldier, get up off of your bed. Get out of your lazy boy recliner. Get busy with the work. It means that we're at our position and alert, and it means that we don't even give a thought to retreat. There's the command to that soldier, right? You stand your ground, right? And what does he say? He goes, I'm not moving back. I don't give a thought to retreating. So this is what we do. Verse 14, stand, therefore. Now he gets into the great passage of the spiritual armor. Now I want you to understand, when he talks about the spiritual armor in the following verses, he divides it into two categories. I don't know if you ever noticed this before, but look at it there. He divides it into two categories. There's the spiritual armor to have, and there's the spiritual armor to take. I'll explain the difference between the two, but verses 14 and 15 describe the spiritual armor that we're to have. Look at it there. He says, stand therefore, having girded your waist with the truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. You can only stand when you're equipped with the armor that God has given us in Jesus Christ. Every aspect of this symbolic armor answers to a specific dynamic in the Christian life that enables us to stand against spiritual attack. Now, you may have heard, and I think it's a wonderful idea, that Paul wrote this letter when he was in the custody of Roman soldiers. It was easy for him to look at the equipment of the guards who guarded him and say, you know what, God has equipped the believer just like that. You know, that soldier has a belt that he has, and it's very important to his equipment. The believer has something like that in their life. That soldier has a breastplate, very important to that soldier. The believer has something like that. I can just see this, how Paul is looking at this, and maybe he's meditating on that passage from Isaiah 59 that we looked at before, and he looks at the Roman soldier and he goes, man, that's it. Look at how that's just like the Christian life. By the way, the order that he lists them here, this is the order in which a Roman soldier would ordinarily put these things on. So it's almost like Paul's watching a Roman soldier get himself dressed. And he goes, that's it, that's it, that's it. And he just thinks and he makes the analogy each step of the way. So first of all, having girded your waist with truth. Truth is symbolically represented as a belt which protects your abdomen, but also it gathers up your garments so that you can fight effectively. Look, you know, I know we like to think of the Romans in these nice little short skirts that they wear, you know, kind of look like a cheerleader skirt or something that they would wear. Typically, people, I'm not saying nobody dressed like that, but I think the common man didn't dress like that. That was fancy clothes. The common man wore this kind of long flowing robe kind of thing. And this long flowing robe, it would get in the way when you were ready to fight. So what would you do? You'd gather it up, you'd kind of fold it up around you, and you'd tie it all up with a belt. It meant that your legs were free to fight. It meant you weren't trying to fight a battle in a wedding dress. And so you don't have this long flowing thing. It's tied up. It's ready to go. And you're ready to fight. I think it's interesting. The belt, strictly speaking, the belt is not part of the armor, right? You don't belt, armor, not really. But yet, before the armor can be put on, the garments underneath have to be gathered together. And so you could make the argument. The belt isn't really part of the armor officially. But if you don't have it, nothing else in the armor works. And by the way, when a man sat down and relaxed, when the soldier was off duty, what did he do? He took off his belt, right? That was almost his way of saying, I'm off duty, right? I'm not ready to fight. The belt's uncomfortable. It bunches up the garments in an uncomfortable way. It's good for fighting, but it's not good for relaxing. So when I'm off duty, I take off the belt. What does Paul say? When is it off duty for a Christian? Like never. You put it on, the belt of truth, all the time. This belt of truth puts on the biblical beliefs of the Christians as a whole. In other words, what other passages call the faith. Many people believe that the church will never go forward unless it takes off its belt of truth, right? That's the way for the church to go forward. You can't be so dogmatic. You move off those doctrines. People don't want to hear doctrine. Just tell them other things. Entertain them today. That's what they want. They're saying to the church, if you want to go forward, take off the belt of truth. No way. You got to have it. By the way, this is armor to have. You know what that means? You have it on all the time. You have it on all the time, the belt of truth. Next, having put on the breastplate of righteousness.
For many of us, studying the Bible is a part of our everyday lives. There seems to always be those sections of Scripture that are difficult to understand. What did Jesus really mean when he said, "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you"? Was Jesus literally telling us to disfigure our bodies? Of course not. We know that's not true. So what does it mean? This is where God has used men like Pastor David Guzik in the writing of commentaries. Pastor David has written numerous commentaries throughout the Bible. In fact, you can find commentary on the entire New Testament and most of the Old Testament at enduringword.com. These commentaries are available digitally at the website and even in mobile format. Concise thoughts about the history, context, and author make these commentaries a valuable resource as you seek to know Jesus more. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and select the book and chapter you're currently studying. Or you can purchase a copy of Pastor David's commentary for your Kindle or even a printed copy. Simply log on to enduringword.com and select books from the main menu. Another great option from Pastor David is his book, Standing in Grace. This book details the fact that those who belong to him are not only saved by grace, they stand in grace. Again, for all these wonderful resources and more, log on to enduringword.com. Well, that concludes our time together today. Please place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.